wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa barak wa sallam. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah. Sorry again that we're starting late. We're looking at the fifth hadith of Imam Nawawi's 40 hadith collection. Today I think we're going to wrap up between 7:15 and 7:30. As you can see, my kids are here. And I've already established that I'm a terrible father. So probably need to be a little bit smarter about getting them to where they need to be. Mashallah. So people can pull up the hadith. We started looking at it last time. This is a hadith on innovation, what's called bid'ah in Arabic. And we're going to delve into it a little bit more. So if you just pull up on your phones, if you have a laptop, if you have the actual text as well, it'd be amazing. You just Google Imam Nawawi's 40 hadith number 5 or Nawawi hadith number 5 and it'll come up. It's a fairly short hadith. And last week, just while people are pulling it up, I'm going to ask someone in a bit just to read it, if you can read it in English or in Arabic, but just so we can get kind of the barakah of reading the hadith. Last week we talked about Aisha radiallahu ta'ala anha, who she is, a little bit about just her scholarship, kind of her contributions to the religion on a whole, what her biography was at a very cursory level. And so far we've looked at four different companions in these five hadith, right? Umar ibn al-Khattab, Abdullah ibn Umar, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, and now Aisha bint Abi Bakr, right? May Allah be pleased with all of them. And this is part of us kind of engaging in this text. We want to know about the individuals also who are the narrators of these hadith, being able to give us insight contextually into kind of the more societal, sociological aspects of the context in which they are living, in which the Prophet is teaching. So we're not just understanding these things in a vacuum, right? Because this is a challenge with text. You can pretty much turn it into whatever you want to at the end of the day. You know, our religion is based off of trying to extrapolate meaning from a text. That's what tafsir is. It's an exegetical analysis. You're taking meaning from the text. What a lot of people do more so these days is more eisegetical. They formulate an argument and then they pick a verse or a narration to say, and this shows that this argument is valid, right? But then you could turn anything into anything, do you know? So when you look at these texts on a whole, you see how they speak to each other, how the verses are of an entire text and not just kind of singled out. And there are different kind of prisms through which we can engage some of these things. So we looked at Aisha radiallahu ta'ala anha's biography a bit. You know, she, in her own right, is, a scholar in every sense of the word, right? She was able to give fatwa. She's someone who is well-versed in the hadith. Yes, what can I do for you? Are you wearing two different socks?
Yeah, but...
Yes.
I put, like, the metal, those two metal things that you have. Okay, she put them in her mouth.
It's okay. Is it out of her mouth now?
Yeah,
okay.
But she just wanted to take
thanks,
them out.
I appreciate it. He came all the way down the hall to tell me this. Isn't he super cute? Mashallah. Yeah, he's great. Alhamdulillah. So Aisha radiallahu ta'ala anha, you know, she is in every kind of discipline someone that we can benefit from, right? And then we talked about just what does this mean? Like, why would someone kind of innovate in a religion? What's the compulsion, the motivation? So it's not just kind of a blanket understanding, but we want to be able to understand if this is something that's problematic through the prism of this hadith, where essentially someone is just, if you're adding something that isn't a part of it, or taking something away that is an essential integral of it, you're just making your own religion at that point, do you know? But to think about what might create those scenarios so that we don't fall into it, right? Like, you literally just saw these three kids that my wife and I are responsible for. We have to be in a place where we recognize the reality of accountability that isn't piecemeal, kind of, you know, understanding and education, but a sense of that what they take from us is going to be something that they will act upon. And then we're going to have to answer to God, like, why did we give that to them? Do you know? And if the claim comes from a previous generation or an elderly generation, like, at some level, there's still accountability as well as a magnification of practice that is problematic, that is accruing now just residual detriment to those who were the starting points of that problematic practice. Do you see what I mean? Right? So if, God forbid, I teach my kid, like, hey, man, you don't really have to pray Fajr. You know, just wake up whenever you feel like it and pray it. You can struggle with praying Fajr. You know, Allah make it easy for us, right? It's not the easiest thing for some of us. But in being able to recognize, there's a difference between saying, this is going to be hard. Let me equip you with an understanding of its value so that, you know, your sleep and what you're doing at night is oriented towards an understanding of recognizing, well, what's the value add of this fundamental pillar of this religion? Versus just flat out saying that, you know, say it was something that I didn't do, right? I pray Fajr, by the way, you know, just so we're all on the same page. And no one tomorrow is going to be like, the guy runs the Islamic Center and he doesn't pray Fajr. Alhamdulillah. But if I now change religion to compensate for my behavior and my actions, it's not just that I'm not doing what is an obligation in the religion, but me teaching that something is not an obligation that is also creates residual detriment back to me. Because when someone acts on something we've taught them, like, if there's good in it, we derive benefit. And if there's not good, there's bad in it, then we derive detriment. Do you see what I'm saying? Right? And so we went into some of this last week, and we're going to kind of pick it up and go into it some more. In case people leave early, I won't be here next Monday. We haven't announced this yet, but I'm going to be going to Egypt on Monday, inshallah. There's some organizations that reached out who have been given permission to have goods go across the border into Gaza. May Allah grant them ease. So we're going to run another campaign that will either launch today or tomorrow. But I'm going to go with that organization. We're going to be filling up these trucks and getting them, inshallah, across the border into the southern part of Gaza. So I won't be here on Monday. But I should be back on Wednesday, inshallah. And so this will be the last Monday session that we have. We'll still have iftar next Monday. And I don't know if there'll be a different program we do on Monday night instead of this one. But then we'll pick up again after mid-January, because the following week, the building will be closed for the winter holiday other than for Jum'ah. And then after New Year's, we're going to be going on the IC's Umrah trip, the January one. So I won't be back until the 12th. There'll still be a lot of other stuff going on, but just so we're all on the same page. And if you know people that are typically here on Mondays and they're not here right now, just let them know as well, inshallah. And then please do give what you can to this campaign. We want to try to pack these trucks with as much as we can. There's going to be what we're calling like dignity and hygiene products that are being given. You know, things for emergency shelter, tents, bedding, etc. Medicines, foods, you know, all of these things. Inshallah, you know, Allah put barakah into it and make it a means of ease for these people. But I'll be going there on Monday night or Monday morning. I'll come back on Wednesday, hopefully, inshallah, by the afternoon. My flight lands in the morning. Okay. Somebody have the hadith in front of them? Yeah, you want to read it, inshallah? Can you read the second part that's written there too?
Yeah. In one version by Muslim, it reads, he who does an act which
Great. So in looking at this now, we want to understand the structure of what these terms mean, right? And this is really important to understand. In religion, like, it's a personal endeavor, but there's still parts to it that are technical terms that have technical meanings. Do you know? Somebody asked me the other day, you know, about how in Islam, someone would say, that someone had said to them that if somebody doesn't pray their prayers, then they're in a state of kufr, right? And she said, I don't understand. And I said, well, there's like different opinions on some of this, if one is categorically kafir or not. But there's hadith where the Prophet ﷺ says, Bain al-mari wa kufri tarku salah, that between an individual and kufr is the abandonment of prayer. And so what people would opine from this hadith is that if one just leaves prayer altogether, then they are not Muslim. And there's others who would say that it's not that it puts them out of the fold of Islam, but in that moment when they are not praying, like, they are in a state of kufr, right? And Allah knows best. And there's complexity to this as to why some people develop different relationships with their prayers, especially as they get elder in age, right? And there's not accountability or ownership over religion or these kinds of things. But when we were delving into it, she said, you know, I don't understand where this comes from. And I shared it with this hadith and like where there was different like opinions on what this means. And then said, but understand, like, if someone is saying that the prayer is not a part of the religion, why that's called disbelief is because that's not believing in what Islam says then. So it's not meant to be like an emotionally charged term. But if you don't follow what is clearly established in the religion, not as a struggle, but kind of embedded in what we're talking about in this hadith, then you're like disbelieving in the religion, right? You're not believing in the religion if you don't say that what's a part of the religion is a part of the religion. That's just making your own religion again. Do you see what I'm saying, right? It's hard when you apply back to oneself because there's a knee-jerk reaction sometimes to be able to say, like, well, you don't know why I do what I do, or this kind of stuff. Nobody's saying that. Do you know what I mean? So even here, this term bid'ah, right, is not meant to be weaponized in a way that we start tearing down into people to say, like, you're doing this wrong, and you're doing that wrong, and you're doing this, and what's wrong with you? You're an innovator, right? But to just understand it conceptually as a technical term and then see where its application is, and then in the frame of self-reflection and contemplation, being open to the idea that there might be certain things that I do that are not a part of the religion. It doesn't mean that everything has to be categorically, explicitly defined as being Islamic in that sense, because there's a lot more that is Islamic than is not Islamic. Do you know what I mean? And that's just how it functions. Do you know? What is haram in comparison to what's halal is like a drop in a bucket, like what is impermissible in terms of what is permissible. So this term bid'ah is a very technical term, and it's in reference to this idea of innovating, adding, you know, changing kind of things that are not meant to be malleable, do you know, and giving it religious connotation, saying that this is rooted in what is religious. Do you know what I mean? So if one was to say, like, there was no live streams during the time of the Prophet of God, well, that's not like an innovation, because that's got nothing to do with what we're kind of defining this term to fit into. Does that make sense? So in being able to understand this now, there's two broader groupings of individuals that would understand this terminology in certain ways. You have just the overall idea that in one grouping, that anything that fits under this quality or category of being a bid'ah is just bad. There's no like room for goodness in it. And then you have in this other grouping of terminologies, what is qualified as a bid'ah hasana, like a bid'ah that has goodness to it. And so examples of this would be like creating the congregational praying of Tarawih, for example. So if you're a Sunni Muslim and you've ever prayed Salatul Tarawih in the nights of Ramadan, that wasn't established as a practice during the time of the Messenger, alayhi salam. Umar ibn al-Khattab, radiallahu anh, is the one that tells people, let's get together and pray now. Because during the time of the Prophet, he came out to pray at night, and the people gathered, and then more people gathered, and then they expected him to come again, and he didn't come out. And, you know, when he did eventually come out some nights later, they said, where were you? And the Prophet said, I didn't want you to think that this was an obligation upon you, you know? Because the whole idea is to not make religion hard for people, right? The same way he says about the miswak, for example, you know, I didn't want it to be hard for people. It's a very common theme and trend in what the Prophet conveys in terms of his teachings and advice and counsel. Because the minute it becomes an obligation, you got to do it. So under Umar radiallahu anh, he says, we understand now that it's not an obligation. And that's why we should resume praying it in congregation, because that would be a better thing to do. This group of people, we're not going to attach labels to them. Do you know what I mean? Right? But the group of people who would say that the bid'ah hasana is a thing, right? They are saying that this was a practice not established during the time of the Messenger of God, alayhi salam. And so within that, that it's like a newly appointed thing, but there's goodness to it. Do you know? What the group that would say there's no good bid'ah would say is that this is not a bid'ah, because what constitutes the sunnah, and last week we said that the opposite of the word bid'ah is sunnah, right? So what constitutes the sunnah also extends into the companions and the four rightly guided caliphs, right? The Khulafa Rashidun, do you know? It's essentially still more or less like the same notion. Do you know what I mean? What you want to be aware of is that when there's 2 billion of us in the world right now, and we've had 14 centuries of a lived tradition, and we are intertwining with different cultures and different societies, and Islam is being influenced in different parameters by these different peoples, there's going to be certain things that get attributed to Islam that have nothing to do with Islam. And then there's going to be certain things that function within the broader frame of Islam that exist because they're just rooted in what is culturally normative and can still be what Muslims do, but it doesn't make it something outside of the fold of Islam. Does that make sense? And then it's not innovative, right? So what do you and I do at a base level? You just got to constantly be in a place where, not through a prism of paranoia, but you are reviewing and revising and learning about religion. Because the minute you learn it, then you've learned it. Do you know? If I said to you tomorrow, like, go make wudu with a bottle of Coca-Cola, right? It's problematic for a lot of different reasons. Do you know what I mean? What determines, though, like the kind of waters that you can use to make wudu? And at this juncture, we should know this. What are the kinds of things you can make wudu with? Do you know what I mean? An elderly man in my kid's Sunday school the other day, we all prayed dhuhr together, and then afterwards he came up to me and he said, I made tayammum because I don't know where there's any water in this building. Like, is that okay? And he was my elder, and I have deference and respect towards him, but there was a bathroom with a faucet like 20 feet away from us. So I said, Sheikh, like, probably better you make wudu and just do dhuhr, do you know? And it wouldn't be okay for me to tell him that that would suffice in that situation when it doesn't suffice. Do you see what I'm saying, right? And that's where it's not necessarily about emotions and feelings. And you got to think about this because it's straight Quran. You know that Allah tells us that there's perhaps something that we like that there's not good in it for us, or things that we dislike that there is benefit in it for us. And in the moment, we might not understand why it is that its application is this way, or how it is that we convey to somebody who's in a circumstance that there's not room to maneuver around this, because this is just what Sharia is, and we're not able to add on to it or deduct from it what is clearly established parts of it. But it doesn't need for us to be the determining factor of what is good and what is not good. Do you see what I mean? So here we have kind of this frame, and what it adds to us, this hadith, and why these hadith kind of follow this sequential order, is that the first hadith in this text is the hadith of intentions, innama al-amalu bin-niyat, and then this hadith talks about actions. So there are scholars who would say that these two hadith make up everything that you need to know about Islam. One is giving you insight onto the inner part, the hadith of intentions, and this part is setting parameters for you now in terms of actions. In understanding where this idea is that someone who adds this act to this affair of ours, something that is not of it, then it's rejected. You want to also see within this, what are then accepted actions? Do you get what I mean? Like, if I know that categorically this is something that beyond anything else, it just has futility to it because there's no mechanism for its acceptance. Do you know? If we pray to Isha and I led you in 8 rak'ahs or 12 rak'ahs, and I said, by my deduction, like if 4 rak'ahs for Isha has this much barakah, then 8 or 12 must have twice or thrice. No, it doesn't work that way. Do you know what I mean? So the additional rak'ahs there, because the intention is to make malleable something that's not, and say the obligation is now something that it isn't, it's not accepted, right? Because I'm not the one that gets to decide that. Do you see what I mean? It only gets enhanced, the understanding of what is then not accepted, when we can understand what is accepted. So what I'd like you to do, just so we can get started talking to each other, what makes an action more likely accepted? And think about it from the parameters of what acceptance means, right? Because the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, who is Khalil Allah, who builds this Kaaba, who, when we make our du'as in our prayers and we send salawat on the Prophet, peace be upon him, we're mostly doing the durood Ibrahim, where we're also sending prayers on the Prophet Ibrahim and his family, right? He has a dua that is just this, Rabbana taqabbal minna, that, O Allah, accept from us, right? It's a constant thing. Just accept from us. May Allah accept it from us. Accept it from us, right? What goes into the acceptance of an act is not necessarily very rigid, but if there's not a conscious awareness of it, then you're not going to be able to apply it when you're inventorying, potentially, or projecting what the day ahead will look like. Inventory meaning, what did I do from the day that just passed me? Do you know? Like, what's going into the acceptance of an action? Does the question make sense? So if you can turn to the people next to you and just talk this out for a few minutes, right? What makes it likely that an act would be accepted? What are the things that need to be present for that to be a potential, a possibility? And then we'll come back and discuss. But go ahead. If you don't know the names of the people sitting around you, just feel free to share. Again, it's not an exercise where you want to only talk if you know the right thing, or avoid if you're worried about saying the wrong thing. But just say, you know, what kind of is coming to mind.
Thank you. thing is, when you get to the
Okay, so what are some of the things that go into this notion of acceptance, right? If this is something that is rejected, that means that there is room for certain things to not be rejected, they're accepted. Why is this an important thing and what goes into it? What did you discuss?
Intention.
Yeah, okay, intention, great, right? This is the first hadith in the book. Innamal a'malu binniyat. Right? Indeed, actions are by their intentions. So, like, what does this mean, though? Intention. What does it mean? You said it.
Like, what's your intention behind the act? Right? If your intention is for goodness of yourself and for the society around you, then it may be accepted.
Okay. Yeah.
I think something also to add about intention is also that it's only for the sake of Allah, not to basically show off or just get any benefit out of it, so the chances are higher for acceptance.
Great. And what's the basis common between these two things that you both just said? Yeah.
I think the purpose behind your actions.
Yeah. But a link here is presence, right? Consciousness, awareness. There's a difference between amal and a fa'il. So if I'm sitting here, and I'm just, you guys are talking and I'm biting my nails, right? I'm going like this instinctively, do you know? Like you blink your eyes, right? These are not conscious eyes, conscious acts. These are unconscious acts, Do you know what I mean? So an intention, like, is first built upon presence and awareness. You can have unconscious acts that are just habitual that also become things that potentially could render benefit. But when you get lost in your prayer, for example, do you know one of the accepted parts of the prayer? Do you know when the mind starts to wander, you don't know what rak'ah you're in, right? We're not looking at this as a good or a bad, but that presence is a pillar that intention is built upon, you know? Now you formulate intention that can be rooted in conviction, in sincerity, right? But what does this mean? And distilling that for oneself, that if that's not there, is it accepted or not? Well, like, if I did the act for Kevin, then why is God going to accept the act when it wasn't for God? Do you know what I mean? Right? Like, if you sent a gift to my kid, then you didn't send it to me. Does that make sense? Do you know? So the intentionality is rooted in this notion. We can have a pumpkin cake that everybody eats, right? Or it can be a pumpkin cake that is only for, like, the people that the maker of the cake likes, right? If you didn't get a piece of cake, now you know somebody doesn't like you in the room. No, but do you get what I'm saying? So there can be intentionality that can also have multiplicity to it, right? It can be multifaceted. But if you don't even know why you're doing what you're doing to begin with, how is that going to be an action that's accepted? Why do you do most of the stuff that you do? Do you know what I mean? And then what does sincerity mean? You know, if we were to flesh that out a little bit, how do you know you're sincere in an act? So how would you answer that?
That question, the questioning itself is a sign of, like, a goodness of the heart, because it's like if you are actually doing it to show off, you would be just, like, very narcissistic about it, and, like, but questioning it and overthinking if, why I'm doing this may be a sign that...
Yeah, or you can problem solve to say, like, maybe I need to not do it in front of people. You know, so if we start to have facets, it's not either or. You pray in front of people in congregation, and you go and pray also non-congregation, right? Do you know? I would say, like, some of the elements of conviction and sincerity within the act, and the one you're doing the act for, is that it's done whether it's convenient or not. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm praying Dhuhr, whether I feel like praying Dhuhr or not, because I'm not doing it because of what I feel, I'm doing it because it's something that's supposed to get done. Do you see? The consistency in it doesn't mean you can't get exhausted or tired, but categorically you start to think out in these ways, having this reflection and contemplation as you kind of look within yourself to say, hey, what does real sincerity look like? What does it mean to be from the mukhlisin? May Allah make us from amongst them. Do you know? And can I have intention that is still for the sake of Allah, that's still for others, right? Like, if we make a cake and other people get happy about it, does that mean that that's still not something that I'm doing for the right intention? No, like, clearly not, right? Intentionality is also not just about the overt expression of it. Now I'm going to sit. Now I'm going to stand. Now I will put my left foot forward. Now I'll put my right foot forward. Now I'm going to scratch my face. Now I'm going to scratch my armpit, right? Nobody does this. Do you know what I mean? Why is that important to understand? Because when the woman slips in the middle of the street and no one is helping her get up or pick up her bags, you're not going to say, for the sake of Allah, I'm coming to lift you up off the ground, right? Do you know what I'm saying? There's still consciousness and awareness, but the intentionality is rooted also in what is innate and instinctive. What are you doing now? But just go figure out with Amaya. Just talk to her about it, okay? Okay, we're going to leave in 20 minutes. It's fine. Okay? Yeah. Thank you.
Do you get his concerns over?
Huh? He's great.
Okay. He still looks like he's like thinking.
It's tough. It's tough being 8 years old. Mashallah. Yeah, make dua for my kids. They're the best blessings in my life. Alhamdulillah. And even there too, right? There's room for intention. Do you know? Sayyid ibn Musayyib, rahimullah, he is a great scholar in our, you know, religious history. He would tell his kids that I do good deeds so that you can benefit for them. Do you know? Like you have the story of Musa and Khidr, and they have the instance where there's treasure buried under this well wall in a town of people that are not hospitable to them. And they're essentially rebuilding the wall so that the kids who should inherit the treasure are going to be recipient of it. But Allah is protecting what is for the inheritors, the children, because the parents were righteous. Do you know what I mean? So if I get up to go and do the things that I do, I know why I'm doing it and who I'm doing it for. And it's not a problem that I can police myself from the avoidance of what's problematic and in the implementation of what our deen deems to be beneficial, because I have a why to it, you know, that I might not be able to do it if it wasn't for the ones that I was doing it for. Do you know what I mean? Inclusive of the community I serve, each one of you. And then building a relationship mindfully with who God is, so that the same way I know my son as best as I know him, and I know where he's at and what he's wrestling with and what he likes and what he dislikes, do I know God with that level of intimacy? So how can you intend to do for an unfamiliar entity? That the presence of what is ambiguous is not going to come through just dhikr and like doing like litanies of a unfamiliar being. Do you know? And so think about the person you love the most in the world. Even if it's you, it's okay to love you, right? But what do you know about this person? What do you know about this individual? And where I can say, I will do something for them. Do you know? When we're done here, I'm going to do something for them. Do you know what I mean? What do they enjoy? I'll take them to the balloon museum. You all should go to this balloon museum. It is so much fun, right? But understanding that I am not, as a 41-year-old man, going to show up alone to a balloon museum by myself and swim through this pool of balloons and play with like the large giant balloons. The kids will all get freaked out if I'm doing that. I know what my kids like. And then I have the ability with conviction to do things that will be pleasing to them because I know them. Do you get what I mean? If you don't know Allah, how will you do things that are pleasing to Allah? Not a textbook answer, right? You could tell me something about 8-year-old boys based off of anecdotal experience and conjecture. If you don't know my kid, you don't know my kid. If you don't know your God, whose fault is that? That's also where innovation becomes important to understand. What are people passing on to you in terms of religious instruction and education and understanding? In my kids' Sunday school, I was asked to do a workshop on prayer, on salah. And they said you could do it over a few different sessions. I'm talking to 5-year-olds to like 12, 13-year-olds, right? I'm not particularly great at talking to 5-year-old children because I talk to everybody like this. Do you know what I mean? My kids seem to be doing okay. They're not like too maladjusted. But to be able to understand that now I have to talk to these babies about salah. What would you even say? And so instead of just talking about wudu and bowing and prostrating, I just talked to them about Allah and who Allah is. And I said, who do you love the most and you know loves you the most and cares about you? And how do you know they care about you? And all these cute little 5-6-year-olds, right, who I was asking questions, you know, because we talked about what is an abd and what is rab. And I said, are there any of you named Abdullah? Raise your hands if you're named Abdullah. The kids raised their hand. And I said, what's your name? And he said, my name is Zain. And I said, it's not Abdullah. He's like, no, I'm Zain. Right? And this other kid, it's like, my name is Omar. And I'm like, does the question not make any sense? Do you know? So then I said to Kareem, I was like, Kareem, your name is now Abdullah. And just for the purposes of this exercise, But when I ask them, like, how do you know this person loves you and cares about you? Every single kid talked about their mom. Maybe like 7 kids in, one kid said something about mom and dad, right? But not dad by himself. And then one kid finally said, my brother, because making him happy makes me happy, right? But the kids say, when I come home from school, my mom always hugs me. That before I leave, she makes me food. You know, she does this, she does that. Do you understand? And then I said, the Prophet says that Allah loves us more than a mother loves his child. And you can't pray as a first step if you don't know who you're praying to. Do you know what I mean? So if I know Kareem, then I can do for Kareem with conviction attached to what pleases Kareem. How do you know what pleases Allah if you don't know Allah? And then sincerity is not this ambiguous thing. If am I doing it for the right or wrong reason? You shift the paradigm and think about it a little bit differently. In order for me to do for anyone that I claim love for, or I claim to understand the love they have for me to do for them, I need to know, like, what is for them. Do you get what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Right? Has anybody ever given you something that you are still nice and kind about it? Maybe not, maybe you're a jerk. But they give you something and you're like, do you have any idea who I am as a person? Like, what is it that you're really thinking I would want this thing or this thing you're asking of me? Do you get what I mean? Right? You can't give deeds to God with that understanding. And Allah makes it super easy because He gave you a whole book to be able to understand Him better. So you want that accepted deed, you got to read the book that tells you like what goes into some of this stuff. Do you see what I'm saying? Does that make sense? The second part to this outside of intention is the actions in and of itself. And there's 3 broader categories that we can align our acts into. There's khair, what is good. There's shar, what is evil. And then there is in the middle, what is laghu. It's neither beneficial or detrimental. There's just no point to it. Most of you are not doing evil things, inshallah, right? Nobody, like, carjacked a cab on the way over here, right? You didn't kick a homeless person, God forbid. Do you know what I mean? You didn't push down an old woman. You didn't steal something from a little child. Do you get what I'm saying? And there are people who do horrendous things. You see the world right now and what the potential of evil is. May Allah protect us from it. It's important to understand, you do not take characteristics always consciously. If you are in spaces that are permeated with an absence of ethics, المرء على دين خليلي فلينظر أحدكم من يخالل, that a person is on the deen of their friend, so be careful the one who you befriend. You can take without permission, and people can give without permission their behaviors, their attitudes, their mindsets, their characteristics. That's why you want to be around good people like you're seated with right now, who can help you remember who it is that you actually are. A lot of us probably also do more khair than we're willing to admit. Because once you can admit and acknowledge your propensity for doing good, you don't really have an excuse to not do it. And when you can acknowledge it also with confidence, confidence is different from arrogance. Arrogance does not go into an accepted action. Confidence can, because confidence can have gratitude that is attached to the divine. With appreciation, I recognize my strengths, the God-given talents I've been endowed with. And then verbally, as well as with my actions, I show appreciation by using them in the ways that Allah wants me to use them. It also allows for me to see my non-strengths, where I have areas to improve. Arrogance just has me see what's wrong with everybody else around me, right? May Allah protect us from it. Do you know? So the acts that you have the ability to do of khair, like, they are actually probably manifold. But what most of what we probably do just fits into the prism of laghu, futility. There's no positive or negative. Why is there even a gain in potentially, God forbid, doing something detrimental? Because this is the deen that teaches us the dua of the sinner quite often is more sincere than the dua of the saint. then when you've treaded down steps where you have made slips and you get back on your feet, there's a different strength in that than being in a place where everything is perfect. And if you don't have struggle in your life, you're probably not actually practicing Islam so well. Do you know? But in being able to understand that middle box, like what is futility? And what goes into this hadith is also a recognition of a metric of assessment. You don't live mindlessly, because mindlessness is not a characteristic of the accepted action, right? Innamal amalu bin niyat, the amal is different from the fa'il, because the amal is an act with consciousness to it. The fa'il is just done unconsciously. So you're in this sphere now where you use a hadith like this that teaches you about bid'ah and what's an accepted act to have the humility to either prior to the day or at the conclusion of the day or at both ends of the day engage in reflective practice that says, what will I put into this day and what was it that I ended up putting into the day? And I can look back with a sense of development and growth, that perfection is not the pursuit, but what did I achieve? Where did I slip? Where is there room for improvement? Where are there things that I should never touch or go near again? Where are there things that I have to shelve for later on? What fits into khair, what fits into shar, and what fits into laghu? Who's going to start their day planning to do something that is futile? Do you know? But realistically, how much of your day today, or a week ago, or a month ago, did you spend doing things that you don't even remember today that you did them? Versus the things that you know do bear impact. Does it mean every minute of your day has to be reading a book, or doing this, or doing that? No, like it doesn't. And in the Seerah class, we talked about this last week, right? That after Asr is one of the times when the Prophet ﷺ would be spending time with his family. And there's actual like narrations where Atta' bin Abi Rabah, rahimahullah, who's a tabi'i, you know, he sees two companions and they're talking about this thing of laghu, and they say that the Prophet ﷺ has said, "Kullu shayin laysa min dhikrillah fa huwa laghu," that all things that are not from the remembrance of Allah, then those are futile, right? Because just think about it. Could you, in the name of Allah, abuse your kid? No, right? Could you, in the name of Allah, be racist? Could you, in God's name, like, not perform your prayer? For the sake of Allah, I'm not praying Fajr today. Does it even make sense? No, right? It doesn't, right? But then they distill it and they say, here are four things that are not laghu. They say running between two lines, right? Physical exercise. Spending time with one's family. Taking care of your mount, your horse, and swimming. These were four things that they mentioned. So if I go to visit my mother and she's watching like some random Indian Pakistani drama that I'm just not into, my intention is not to sit there to kind of pontificate. I'm just grateful I get to spend time with my mom. And the paradigm shift is such that what? I'm spending time with family. That's just what it is. The Prophet made after Asr the time he spends with his family when the sunlight is out, not at the end of the day when everything is dark and everyone's asleep and you're tired, but a primary mode. Do you see what I mean? And so you want to start to see hadith like this also as a mechanism to say that you have to begin to assess what it is that you're putting into the world. I have to assess my decisions, my choices, my actions. It doesn't mean that I go overnight into this rapid, like, remodeling of who I am, unless you're a terrible human being, right? Then stop that nonsense now. Don't hurt people, don't abuse people, don't mistreat people, don't talk to people poorly. Don't take people for granted, right? Apologize for the wrong that you've done. Express gratitude. These are not things that you want to wait on. But there has to be a system that sees yourself, like anybody, as a work in progress. We don't have this notion that is that much more prevalent in my anecdotal experience in terms of people walking into my office who are running on empty because the world is super heavy and it makes sense that you're exhausted. But what adds to it, when you're feeling bad because the world is bad, then you start to tell yourself, why should I even feel bad? What am I going through? Look at what everybody else is going through. Not helpful ways of thinking. You cannot compare struggles in this way. It is subjective, and Allah's divine decree and wisdom that plays a role in determining what it is that comes in front of us and the ways that it comes in front of us. But when you start to now feel sad or bad, you add layers of negativity to it that just crush you even more. Do you see? And in the prism of doing, then, it creates paralysis. So where do I have healthy modes of assessment and metrics? The Prophet is telling us, Aisha radiallahu ta'ala anha is telling us through the words of the Messenger, hey, take a look at what you're doing. Be conscious and be aware of some of these things. And understand that you are the only one that can essentially really police yourself. You want to have a starting point of some of this. Understand that the kind of state that you're in primarily is something that you can see at its truest forms of who am I when no one else's eyes are on me? Like this question of, do I just pray for people because they're around me? Well, like, what do you do when you're sitting by yourself? Right? And that can't be a self-deprecating act. But when you're at home alone, you're like in your bathroom alone, right? You are anywhere alone, or even you're surrounded by people, but there's still aloneness because nobody knows who you are. It's giving you an indication of where that frame of God consciousness is. You know, what am I doing in those hours when it's just me with me? What are those things that are taking place? That's not about, again, self-deprecation, but it's about just reflection. For me to get to a place, I have to know where I actually stand in relation to it. And a lot of us don't reach goals, not because we don't define objectives, but we're not being vulnerable with where we actually are as a starting point. If I am sitting here and I'm trying to get right to where the clock is on the wall in front of me, but in my head, I've told myself that I'm actually there because I don't want to confront certain parts of me. Then I take the steps that I would if I was starting from there to get to the clock and I go at a diagonal. I'm not getting there, not because I don't know where I want to end, but I don't know where I'm beginning. And those steps from here are going to put me over there. Do you get what I'm saying? So when you have the ability to be reflective, it's going to only be productive also if you know how to be kind to yourself. And this is where you go back to the notion of doing for the sake of Allah, because Allah tells you on page one, before anything, that He is Rahman and Rahim. So don't forget it. And that if you were a population that did not make mistakes or sin, we would be replaced by those who did, because Allah would replace us with those that He would forgive. Do you get what I'm saying? These can't be treated as just like sound bites. You have to treat them as actual factual statements. And a factual statement rooted in the context of this hadith is that if you don't take yourself into account here, you're going to still be taken into account when you leave from here, right? So where Umar says, radiallahu anhu, حَاسِبُوا أَنفُسَكُمْ قَبْلَ أَن تُحَاسِبْ, that take yourself into account before you're taken into account. And in the midst of that, you start to think out, hey man, I just spent like 8 hours of my day watching 20-second clips on TikTok and YouTube. And if you do the math of what that adds up to, right? 8 hours, probably a lot. 3 hours. Do you know what I mean? Which is probably what some of us do. It doesn't mean it's bad. There could be like some things that we're gaining from it, but a part of it is probably just really mindless. You have strategy that says, I'm going to cut it down to 2.5 hours, and I figure out with that 30 minutes, what else am I going to do? Cut it down to 2 hours and 15 minutes. Cut it down to 2 hours and 45 minutes. So you start to reclaim some of that time that you've been allocated in this world, right? Because what did the hadith before this say? Where Ibn Mas'ud radiallahu an, he is talking about the things that have been decreed already. One of them was what? Your lifespan. Do you see? And so now this next hadith is talking to you about deeds and actions, and it's telling you, here's something that's not going to get accepted. So what is going to get accepted? What did I do for the majority of my day today? Do you know? What is it that I'm spending my time doing? Do you see what I mean? Why couldn't I go to a soup kitchen this weekend? Because nobody else is going? Why couldn't I go visit the sick? Because nobody else is doing it? Why do I have to let somebody else be the first one to like serve food or to clean up something? Do you see what I mean? What am I waiting for to call someone that I haven't seen in a long time? This guy came here, his name is Faisal Ghori. I've known him for 20 years. I haven't seen him in years. He walked in, I gave him a hug, he gave me a hug. And then I said, like, let me know next time you're in the city, because he's not from New York. But if we make time for each other, that's not a bad thing. Would I do that over, like, just mindless scrolling? Would I do that over backbiting and gossiping? If you've ever met somebody who has a smoking addiction, right? May Allah make it easy for them. One of the ways, not always, absolutely, that helps people break that habit is when you are able to compile just data of numbers on the amount of dollars they're spending on cigarettes in a day, in a week, in a month. And when they look at it and they are saying that this pack-a-day habit, this three-pack-a-day habit that I have, this multi-pack-a-day habit that I have is costing me like this many thousands of dollars, I could be flying to Hawaii. I could be doing like all kinds of stuff. Cigarettes are not cheap, man. I don't smoke, by the way. Somebody left a box of cigarettes here the other day, and we have a bad habit of just trying to hold everything for everybody. From a Sharia standpoint, if you pick up somebody's belongings, like the fiqh of it is, you have to hold that for a year in case somebody comes back to claim it. You can't just use it for yourself or like give it away or throw it away, whatever. So sometimes it's better to just leave the thing where you find it. So now we got this box of cigarettes. It's Jummah time. Was it after Jummah? Yeah, after Jummah, you know, stressful. Jummah is a stressful experience, so, you know. And now walk in, there's a box of cigarettes sitting in the IC, right? This thing is like a number of pain for many people. People sometimes turn towards these outlets because they don't have community support. But where we want to help people is not by berating them. But so one of the ways that people understand this is when you can visually represent to them, like, hey man, the amount of money you spent on killing your lungs, you could like be paying for a car lease. And then they just have to confront the idiocy of the decision making. Do you get what I mean? So not just in your head, but you take a notebook that you stay true to, right? This is why the word fiqh in Arabic is reflection, and mufakir is a notebook in Arabic, right? There's a connection there. And you just write out what you did throughout the course of the day today. And most of what everybody does is going to be great. Don't go in with the objective of, go in with an assumption that's not objective, because shaitan will get you to be able to think like, here's everything that I did today that sucked. Here's everything that I did that makes me a terrible human being. No, man. Khair shar lagu. You're going to have done a lot of things that were khair, and you'll be surprised. Like, oh man, like I did actually do these things. And that'll just perpetuate more good. Do you see what I mean? Right? And it'll allow for you to then feel compelled to say, like, tomorrow could be even better. And then you'll have a mechanism also when a week from now, it doesn't seem like there was so much, but you learn about yourself to say, well, you know what? Like, I just got in a fight with my mom. Or I'm in a place where I had a tough argument with a friend. Or I just failed an exam, work was hard, people are racist, nobody understands me. It impacts like what then comes up consequently, right? This is why we live an entire life and we are judged in accordance with an entire life. But you have the beauty of a God who shows that he looks for moments to accept, Azawjal. So the woman who's a known prostitute is given Jannah by just giving water to a thirsty animal, right? Do you see what I mean? Does that make sense? You don't want to leave it to chance though. So Rabbana taqabbal minna, right? O Allah, accept from us, is also then, if you're serious about the dua, you apply it to be like, what were the things that I was actually giving for the sake of Allah today, doing for the sake of Allah, that are attached to like what pleases God? And how do I build an intentionality that I want to make God as happy as I want to make my son when he comes in? Do you see this kid, man, walking in, cheeks blushed, smiling with like his semi-toothless smile? Do you know? He's cute. Wouldn't you want to make him happy? Do you know what I mean? You all are in places where if you had the chance, this kid, can I have this candy? Here, have the candy, right? Can I have this? Can I do that? Yeah, because there's an inherent attachment, not to just his cuteness, but his innocence. There's a purity to that beauty. Allah is infinitely more beautiful than my son. The purity of the divine is something that you can't even fathom or imagine. And when you allow for your heart to be in pursuit of ma'arifah and have an intimate knowing of the divine, you're not going to want to stop doing for the sake of God just because you want to. You're not going to expect my son to come back to you if you give him cake or candy and say, I gave you cake yesterday, where's mine today? You see what I mean? And that's where the love component comes in the action. Rabi al-Basri, may Allah be pleased with her, she says, I will not serve God like a laborer in expectation of my wages. You just do because you want to do. And it's not something that's intangible, but the starting point is, if I don't have the room to do what I want to do for the ones that I want to do for, that I love and I care for, including me, you have to be important enough to yourself that you are doing right by yourself. Then some of what will make it easier is to like cut out the clutter that is overwhelming the minutes of the hours that you've been allocated, to say, is this really the stuff that I'd rather be doing? Can you imagine me saying to you, I would rather be just watching some random thing on my phone than laughing with my son and my daughter? No, right? But it's tangible. You see them. Do you know what I mean? They're not like snotty kids. They're nice kids. Do you know what I'm saying? But like, why are you then filling your time up with the stuff you fill your time up with? You know? And this hadith is telling us, here's a metric of assessment. There's no point to doing these things that are bid'ah. They're rejected. And then you use your principles of logic to say, if something can be rejected as an act, then there must be something that makes an act also be accepted. What are the acts that I'm doing? What are the likelihood that those things would be accepted acts? Am I engaged in the pursuit of decisions that are just about the pleasure of my boss, the people that write my checks? Is the intentionality rooted in the validation of just what is of the world? Or is there something that is bigger than some of this? There's entire genres of hadith that are prefaced with the construct of the best of deeds are. You should go look them up. The best deeds in the eyes of Allah, the best of actions this, the best deeds this, just like there's the best of so much stuff, right? You know, the, you know, best of people, the best of women, right? The best days of the year. Like there's so much that's there. So you start to think out some of these things. Hey, and where can I apply them in this sphere of my day, of my week, of my month? The idea is not to be like a super Muslim on steroids also. You just go at a pace that makes sense for you, right? And what you'll find is there'll be more meaning in like the limited things that get done when you cut out the things that have no purpose, because they also take away consciousness and presence. And it'll allow for there to be then opportunity to feel like the sweetness of an act that is done in pursuit of God's pleasure. Does that make sense? Okay. So if you can turn towards the peoples next to you, what is some of the stuff you're taking away from tonight's conversation? What is it bringing up for you? And then we'll come back and discuss, make some announcements, and then we'll take a pause for today.
Like, Marvel, like, Marvel, like,
Okay, so what are some of the things we're taking away today? Anything coming up for people? Yeah. Yeah, right. I go to places a lot and people ask me about my wife and my kids and they say, you talk about them so much, we just know certain things about them. Do you know what I mean? Here's like this gift for your wife. I'm like, do you know my wife? No, but we read what you write about her or hear what you talk about her. It's fundamentally like something that you can apply to your relationship with the divine. Do you know? And you can't do it if you have this mental block that doesn't acknowledge it. If you don't read the Quran, how will you know what the Quran says? And if you're in a place where the fundamental block of acceptance is sincerity, to do for the sake of Allah or for Allah's pleasure, then like read the book that is there to help you learn about who Allah is. Do you see what I mean? Right? And with this intentionality, not as just an exercise, it has to be read this much or this many times, but with reflection and contemplation that then enhances the experience. Do you know? What else? What else are we taking away from today? Yeah.
So upon reflecting on some of the things that you mentioned, I think I was able to reflect on. So you mentioned how we, how something is like unlawful in Islam or like how it's immoral or like haram, right? And two things that I understood on how you were discussing things was how we end up normalizing, how we're surrounded by people who end up normalizing the abandonment of our obligatory things, such as finding our way around what makes a prayer accepted versus how it's actually meant to be accepted, right? And then when one thing is, let's say, mentioned as haram, right? We know is haram. We can either seek to, without being conscious or mindful, we end up either normalizing the abandonment of like obligatory things, or we can end up choosing the route of really unraveling our intentions and purifying them and being in a conscious state of mind where we really seek the pleasure in with the divine in like an unconditional manner, right? Not like doing our actions, not praying or not doing good deeds because of one external validation, the way society or people perceive us, how they think we are represented in the society. And then secondly, not doing it with getting anything in return or doing it out of convenience. So just doing it purely for and in an unconditional state of manner where I reflect on this. So as a parent or when we have a child, we unconditionally love our children, right? And then looking at God in the same way, looking at the divine in the same way, where we're constantly in the cycle of being better, understanding what our intentions are and why we do the things that we do. Instead of, sometimes I have been a part of actually groups where like there's no room to be, to understand my intentions and better myself because people already normalize what isn't appropriate, right? Such as, oh, okay, I'm always tired for Fajr. Let me pray whenever I want, right? And then someone else, like you'll have like three other people making excuse for how that's okay versus being like, okay, how can we actually learn to wake up on time, right? And then you are left out in a way that like you can no longer have people accountable for their actions of being in a conscious state, right? So we can, I think when we are no longer conscious or mindful, we are in a state of like ignorance, and then we kind of normalize that ignorance is bliss and all of that. So we can either fall into that state or either just understanding who we are as individuals, taking that like that alone time that we have with ourselves as a gift of purely understanding why we do things, right? And not really looking at it with external validation. When we make a cake for someone, thinking that we're doing it out of love and not because we ever need anything, you know, in return. And that's how I constantly do anything in my life, and hoping that I never really want anything in return. And then also with the divine, my connection, in hopes that, you know, I'm in circles that also seek the same thing. But that's the two things that I kind of connect to. And I think as a parent, I always see the love that they give with their children and how unconditional it is. Like, they can do anything to you, and then, like, you'll still love them as a parent, right? And then versus you can do anything, like, you can make mistakes, and God will always accept it, given that you are constantly improving your intentions and purifying them and really holding yourself accountable to being better, right? And then another thing you connected was, like, the so-called prostitute, the woman, right, that fed water to the animals. Was the animals? Can you correct me if I'm wrong? Was about it, right? So she did, like, she went to Jannah because her intentions definitely, like, it purified in a way that God understood her, right? That she went to Jannah. But today, in today's world, the whole world would be against her, be like, oh, okay, we did Umrah, we prayed 5 times, we did so many things. How did she go to Jannah when maybe we didn't? We did all these good deeds, but we probably did it for external validation. We probably did it for all the immoral, like, we did it for an outlook that wasn't purely, you know, as a reflection of who we are, but she did it as a reflection of being good to those animals, right? So that's very interesting. And then I also noticed that a lot of people choose to sin, and they intentionally sin by saying that they're living their life, so they're going to choose to live their life in a certain phase when they know something is haram, and then out of nowhere they're going to say, yeah, and then we'll do Umrah, then we'll pray 5 times, then we'll start hijab. They sin with an intention of sinning, ignorance, right? Mm-hmm. Being ignorant, and then to seek the pleasure of the divine. Versus her, she was unconsciously in the state of sinning as a so-called prostitute, Allah forgive her, and then her intentions purified. So I kind of connected that within the umbrella. I'm sorry for taking up so much time, but so we can choose two routes of normalizing ignorance. And I think also this is a reflection of me holding myself accountable, that if me or any one of us are in groups where people normalize the abandonment of obligatory things in their own excuses, that we kind of not only tell them to reflect on how they can purify their intentions, but how we can do it. So we kind of pursue the cycle of making the world better, right? Kind of.
Yeah, and I would just say with a caveat that, like, if you're going to give someone advice, make sure that you're speaking to them and not at them, because there's a thin line between becoming like the haram police and turning people away from religion. Many people turn away from religion because of religious people, and that's just something that's a reality, do you know? The next hadith that is in this text says what you said, right? The halal is clear and the haram is clear, right? This is the next hadith, the sixth hadith, do you know? But embedded in what we're talking about now, you use it as just a metric of assessment, and there's complexity to it, so we don't want to overtly kind of reduce it to something simplistic. But if it's time to pray, and I don't pray because my boss does not want me to pray, then I'm doing what I'm doing because of my boss's pleasure or mispleasure. And then I'm not doing it because of Allah's pleasure or mispleasure. This is different from like a safety concern. This is different from somebody's going to actually hurt me. This is different from like a plethora of reasons as to why one may or may not do. I'm not telling you that it's easy. I'm saying just think about it at this fundamental level. Where does God factor into the decision? And understanding that Allah knows us better than we know ourselves, but the only thing we present to Allah are our actions and our deeds. And so the hadith is saying, hey, just keep yourself in check once in a while. So if there's something that's causing you to veer off, make istighfar and turn back to Allah. This is what tawbah is. You're returning back to God, right? If something's going well, don't abandon it, right? Enhance it, implement it with regularity. But it doesn't have to be like an everyday thing, but there's consistency to it. So reading one verse of Quran is something that's good if you're doing it every day, right? You could do more than that, but you go at a pace that makes sense for you. It's very different than if you read the whole thing in a day, a week, a month, and then you don't touch it the rest of the year. And that's not just conjecture, it's like reality, right? This deen says, engage it daily, is categorically different than you went on a marathon for a day and then you don't touch it again. But you bring it down to this place of acceptance. If you are changing Allah's religion, how can you do that for the sake of Allah? Are you thinking that God got it wrong? So the innovative practice, like what's the basis of it in this prism of acceptance? And then at this foundational level, how can I do something for your sake if I don't know you? How can I just claim like what is pleasing, you know, in a way that doesn't make any sense? When I take my kids to different countries, and people are really nice, but it's a different culture. And my kids, you know, they're semi-polite human beings. Somebody gives them something and they don't even know what it is. But in that place, that's what they give to kids. They're giving based off of their understanding of the children around them. Not my children, which is not a problem, right? How will they know the things that they don't know? But you know what your loved one likes to eat, just like you know what you like to do and what you like to eat. Do you know what is pleasing to Allah and displeasing to Allah? And that fits into this sincerity and acceptance kind of variable. Do you see what I mean? So in a few weeks, we'll pick up. I thought this was going to go a lot quicker than it has been, and that we would get through like most of these hadith by the end of December. We've gone through 5 of them. And, you know, alhamdulillah, like there's a lot more you can extrapolate. What you want to do between this Monday and the next Monday that we're blessed, inshallah, to come together in this way is like start to revisit these hadith, try to memorize them, so that they actually come into mind when you're doing certain things, so that they inform and become a basis of a moral philosophy through which you're making decisions and choices, do you know? And exert an understanding of compassion to oneself as well as to others, that recognize that I make excuses for them, but for me, like the excuses, what are they really yielding for me, do you know? And then I start to move forward in a way that's just step by step. And then we'll pick up with the 6 hadith in January, inshallah. We're running this clothing drive for immigrants, for migrants and asylum seekers here in New York. The boxes were like about twice as many, and one person came and picked up a lot of them today. He's going to be delivering on Wednesday, inshallah. And as he came to take those boxes, we had about 3 Amazon drivers come with 3 full loads of boxes each, all at the same time. And that happened 3 times today. That's gonna happen every day, inshallah, for the rest of this week. So we need help to unpack and categorize. If you can be here between now and Friday to do some of that, that would be really amazing. If you have clothes that you can contribute, you can get stuff. We're not gonna do it past Friday. So that's going to be a cutoff for us. If you bring things from home, just make sure they're washed and clean and they're not worn down. You know, they're things that we're going to literally give to people to wear in the cold because they're just sleeping outside in the cold. So it's not going to work if we give them jackets with holes in them or socks with holes in them. Do you know what I mean? But just clothing also. So no books, no toys, no this or that. Right? And people ask questions very genuinely. Someone reached out saying, like, can I bring some saris for people? Like, no, it's not going to work. A sari is not going to help someone on the street. You know, so it's not like a closet cleaning for us. You want to think mindfully, like, what are the people going to need? And, you know, bring it by this Friday, inshallah. And if you can help us to unload, that'd be great. And, you know, what I mentioned in the morning or in the beginning of this session, I'll be going to Egypt on Monday, inshallah, working with some organizations that are getting goods across the border into Gaza. And we'll put out a campaign probably at some point, like tomorrow, the day after. If you can contribute it, share the links so we can get as much as we can to fill these trucks and get them across the border. It's all Zakat eligible and tax deductible. And so it can, you know, be anybody really contributing to it. If you know people in Canada, like there's going to be tax deduction for Canadians as well as Americans. So please help us in spreading the word on that as well. Okay, let's take a pause here. My wife asks you, we ended at 7:30, okay? And that's what ended up happening. All right. Assalamu alaikum. We'll see everyone. Inshallah. Take care.
We just saw
the live. Huh? No, my wife does not watch or listen to that.